All right, so today you don't have the familiar voice of Frank. You get to put up with me, Robert, and our special guest will be Greg from our North Fort Myers store, who's been working at the shop for, 15 years?
Yeah, just about that.
Takes care of the North Fort Myers store. And, of course, we got RJ here. So, how you doing, RJ?
I'm doing good, and I'm actually looking forward to seeing the show. How does a show go without Frank in the middle of it?
So am I. I'm kind of curious and nervous all at the same time.
All right, well, let's go get him.
Nothing to be nervous about. We got this under our thumb. No problem.
Yeah. Right. So, one thing that we've had a lot of people asking about this week, in addition to the beautiful weather and where are all the fish at, is we were talking a little bit last week about the trout fishing and the trout regulations. You know, trout fishing has been, to say the least, fair to partly junky, you know, this year. And part of it's red tide, part of it's weather. But, you know, Greg and I years ago used to write. And
yeah, we used to write an article for the Coastal Angler every month. And we did that for 5 years. And in February of 2012... that was when FWC decided to open trout year-round to harvest. It used to be closed in November and December, which was the spawning months for the trout. And there were all kinds of trout back then. Big trout, little trout. They were ran the gamut.
Just more plentiful, absolutely.
They were very plentiful. And when they first opened it, everybody thought, oh, this is great. But as we predicted in our article in February of 2012, that it would be 5 years before the trout fishery kind of went to crap because they opened it year-round. They not only opened it year-round for recreational anglers, they opened it and increased the limit for the commercial guys, which they're making a living. I'm not going to diss them over that, but they added 50 pounds of catch per day per man and added 2 more months of catching them. Well, guess what? That reduced the amount of fish we had dramatically, in my opinion. I don't have any scientific data to show backing that up, but all I have to do is listen to the customers coming to shop asking me, where are all the trout? How come I can't catch any trout? Well, you've caught them all already.
It's called observation science.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't have to be true, legitimate science. I mean, there's so much data and information that even real scientists gather just from daily anglers and people in general with their observations out there, and they try to take that into account. So yeah, it's pretty accurate that.
And they're trying to do something about it. Now I think they're going about it the wrong way. They've stepped up here in the last week or so. It was released. Before, you used to be able to keep one of your trout was allowed to be over 20 inches.
Yeah,
now you can't do that.
15 to 20 inches.
15 to 20 was the slot.
4 per person per day, and one of those 20. 4 could be over 20, but now none of them can be over 20. It has
They've
to
be
15 to 20 inches, period.
Yep.
You know, and which I'm torn on it, you know, and I like the idea of the closure in November and December the way it used to be, because they do actually spawn 2 times a year,
right?
Depending on the weather and Mother Nature, but usually there was the fall period when was their primary time when they would be full of roe, and then they did one in the springtime, usually in May, April, May. So that was their theory, is that since they're a multi-spawner, that it theoretically wouldn't hurt the population as much,
I think
there's been a collage of things, but I definitely agree that having it open year-round has definitely put
an impact. The extra catch for the commercial guys certainly impacted them. The extra 2 months for recreational anglers to be allowed to take them, and when you consider the 2 months that they opened, November and December, what do we have in November and December around here?
Thanksgiving and Christmas.
And lots of snowbirds.
Lots of visitors coming down to visit the snowbirds.
And what are they catching? Trout.
Trout, because it's usually one of the more abundant fish
to catch. More abundant, easily
great,
catchable.
Great eating for most people, yep. You know, so it's got all the way around kind of a...
Got a whole lot of bad things happening all at one time.
Yeah, kind of a recipe for catastrophe.
Yep. And
what do you think, RJ?
I've read a lot of studies on the marine sanctuaries where they look at the impact of recreational fishing versus the impact of commercial fishing. And any slight increase in the commercial catch has a major impact, way more than you would get from increasing the catch with recreational fishermen.
Exactly.
So, you know, when you let the commercial fishermen take 50 pounds of fish per man, that doesn't compare
per day.
That doesn't compare at all to a recreational angler who's going to take 4 fish.
Right.
You know. And the other thing that happens that they found in the marine sanctuary studies is the commercial catch tends to wipe out areas, blocks of space in the sanctuary, because they're either netting or they're long lining, and they're catching lots of fish from one area, where you don't necessarily get that with recreational anglers. They're pulling fish from different areas. And so the system stays together pretty well. When you start separating the trout and they go to spawn, you know, there's no trout around to spawn with.
Right.
So that's part of the problem.
Absolutely.
And that is another thing with the trout. Pretty much like all of our game fisher, they do tend to school by size.
Yeah.
So if you get on a school of 25-inch trout, pretty much all those fish are going to be in that 25-inch slot. Those are your spawners.
Right.
You know,
oh, absolutely.
And you get somebody comes in there and just wipes them out, you know.
Right. I think the other thing they looked at, too, is predation. And a lot of, like in our case with trout, there's a lot of fish that eat trout.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
Just about everything eats them, no matter what size they
Dolphin.
Are. They get eaten by something, right?
Well, and even bigger trout eat smaller trout.
That's right.
You know, they're no problems being cannibalistic, as in most species of fish.
So you get to some tipping point in the population, you know, where you've got increased commercial pressure, increased recreational pressure, and the pressure from the predators didn't go away.
No.
No. So.
Not at all. But, you know, if you do want to go out and catch some trout, you know, I've been getting some mixed reports of them, a lot of smaller guys, but the main thing is the guys that are doing well, fishing some of those deep grass beds down there in
right.
the Pine Island Sound
Pine
area.
Island Sound down in Matlache.
What are you hearing from the store down there?
And that's exactly what I'm hearing. They're doing well over the grass down that way.
Any particular area?
Yeah, I was hearing more towards the Pine Island side, south of Captiva.
Okay.
That's where
below Captiva Rocks and
yep,
what is that, Rat
yep.
Key and Cat Key that's below
yep,
there too?
That's all that area. They were doing well there. Then it kind of slowed down, and guys were going, oh, it's not so good now. Then they had come back around over onto the other side, on the Matlache side, in the Matlache Pass. And they were doing real well just north of the Indian Fields and that.
Okay.
They were doing well there. And then the next thing I'd heard, they were down around the power lines.
Okay.
And all doing, a lot of them were doing, of course, shrimp on a bobber, one thing or another, but I had a lot of guys telling me they were doing well in topwaters.
Okay, and that's cool because topwaters, I mean, we always talk about it once in a while, but that's actually a pretty good one to talk about because I've had a lot of topwater guys this week.
Sure.
You know, I'm hearing it of jack, snook, trout, some redfish, some guys that are throwing the topwaters way offshore for some of the amberjack and stuff,
yep.
So, I mean...
And this is the time of year for that. I mean... There's limited amounts of natural bait, so if you can even throw a topwater that looks remotely like it should be there, you should catch fish. And it's not just the trout. I mean, nothing better than catching a big old snook on a topwater. I mean,
right.
If the snook gets a hold of it, that is. I think they need glasses. You know? they're
well,
great for blowing it out of the water. But,
so are redfish.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, redfish aren't designed to take topwaters, but they will. And if you watch, you know, they've got that undercut jaw, they'll roll up on a topwater. Where
right.
a snook just comes up, they've got that protruding lower jaw, and they just boom, and they're slamming it, you know. And it's off to the races. A lot of times, and I've caught a lot of reds on topwaters, you don't actually get them like you want to get them. You really foul hook them a lot of times.
Right, they get it on the side of the face or the top of the head.
Exactly. You think you've got a 40-inch redfish on there, and it turns out it's 14.
Right.
Because you're pulling him sideways.
But, now, what would be your favorite topwater, RJ?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one for me because I'm not much on topwater.
No?
No, I'm, you know, a little lower down in the food column there, in the water column is where I usually am.
He wants one of those throw it in the water, turn the handle.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that because, I mean, honestly, topwater baits as a rule are what you would consider a finesse bait. You actually have to work that lure. You can't just cast it and reel it. You know, in the case of your traditional topwaters, like, say, a Zara Spook or a
Skitterwalk.
Rapala Skitterwalk, yep. Those are basically they're a stick.
Yep.
And you've got to do what they call walk the dog. And essentially what that amounts to is you've got to rub your belly and pat your head. And if you're not good at that,
you're not going to be good at walking the dog.
It's very tricky to do the walk the dog. But essentially a walk the dog is, and correct me if I'm saying this, actually, you're darn good at topwater, so you should probably explain how to use a topwater for a beginner.
Okay.
Whether you're standing on a pier or a boat,
yeah,
it's kind of the same technique.
If you're standing on a pier, it's really hard to fish one because most of them are too far out of the water. I mean, you need to be close to the surface of the water to throw that lure and work it effectively because you get too much of an angle on it. Say you were standing on the pier down at Bayshore and you're standing out there, you're 8 or 9 foot up off the water and you're trying to throw that lure and work it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too hard of an angle. I mean, I'll fish it off the dock out in back of the house. That's fine, you know, because I can get my rod tip right down to the water.
Because that's what you want to do. You want to point your rod tip as close to the water surface as
exactly.
possible.
And it's, as you're turning, like you said, rub your belly, pat your head at the same time, because you're turning the handle on the reel and working the rod at the same time. You're giving it a slight twitch. I mean, after you've got it doing the swinging back and forth in the water, which is where the walk the dog part comes in on it.
Yeah, the lure will zig and zag as you twitch that rod tip, and you're really only moving barely your
literally,
wrist. You're not moving
you're
your whole arm.
You're just kind of snapping your wrist.
Your wrist should be just barely moving, but if you watch your wrist as you're making that movement, your wrist is only moving maybe an inch and a half, but your rod tip is actually moving about 6 to 10 inches.
Yep.
And it causes a little sweep with that rod.
And just as
pulls
it hits
your
that
line
far
tight,
end of the swing.
And you're reeling at the same time, so you're reeling up a little bit of that slack and pulling it tight, causes that lure to zig to the right, and then as you twitch it again, it causes it to zig back to the left.
Yep.
So you're just getting this nice little
I
want to
go left and right, not right and left.
Okay, that works. You know, so you just walk that, but the most important part is, like you said, you got to hold that rod tip pointed towards the water. If you're standing on a pier,
you can't hold it up here and do this and make it work. You have to have the
you can't see that on radio, though. You can't hold your rod tip up.
You can't hold it above your head like you're reeling in, you know, a fish.
Yeah.
And make that work. I mean, I suppose somebody has probably tried it.
What it does is if you got too much of an angle on your line, it pulls the nose of that bait
up out of the water.
And so you've only got the tail section sitting in the water at any given time, so you can't get that sideways motion. So you're almost reeling in just a stick. It just gives it a straight pull at that point. But for me, you know, I'm good at working a Zara Spook, but it took some practice. But probably one of the easiest topwater baits that I found, especially for beginners that just want to kind of get a feel for it and learn how to do it, because there's nothing more exciting and exhilarating than a fish blowing up on your bait on the surface, because it doesn't matter how comfortable you are, it always makes you flinch even a little bit, if not flat out jump.
Mm-hmm.
But like something, a prop bait, like a Tiny Torpedo, Smithwick's Devil Horse, those lures are absolutely amazing, but you know, that lure, it's got the prop on the front and the back, or just on the back. And all you do is just pull your rod tip. You're once again, you're still pointing your rod tip towards the water, but you give it a little bit harder pull, and it causes that prop on the front or the back or both to spin and chudder through the water and pulls that bait forward, but it's creating noise and a little bit of a visual emotion. Effect with that spray. You know, and that's a much simpler bait.
And it's a great snook lure.
Yeah, everything.
The torpedo is great for bass.
Everyone knows it for bass fishing.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
You know, but another one that you probably use when you were younger up north for some of your bass fishing that a lot of people have in their box that don't stop and think that it would work in salt water because they associate it with nothing but fresh water is a jitterbug.
Yep. I was going to say the jitterbug is a great lure. Especially if you're a beginner and you're trying to work something on the surface. That thing just kind of chugs along and paddles along on its own.
Yeah.
And it makes that bubble trail behind it that seems...
Well, and that's essentially what the Smithwick and the Torpedo do. Yeah.
And the Tiny Torpedo
making a trail.
Is a fairly easy lure to work.
Yep.
Yeah.
You get something out of it. When you get into the spook, you're right. You got to really know how to work that. Otherwise, you're fishing a stick.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I've been throwing spooks for years. I mean, for literally everything, including muskie and northern pike and stuff like that. And they don't hold up well to them anymore because now they're plastic and they just pretty much crush them, you know.
Yeah.
They're a one-and-done lure with, you know, that type of
anything
fish.
Anything with teeth.
Yeah, anything with teeth, they're done once.
Which is most saltwater fish,
right?
Yeah, way more here than your freshwater stuff. Yeah. But my youngest son, Jake, he's 22 now, I guess. But he started fishing with me when he was about 9, and you know, I mean, I absolutely knew what I was doing with him. He kept dinging me about he wanted to throw a spook, and I says, "You're not ready for this yet, boy." He goes, "Oh, come on, Dad, let me try it." And I says, "Okay, you know what." So I tied one on for him. He threw the damn thing in the water, and in 2 minutes he was walking that thing like he'd been doing it for 30 years.
The apple didn't fall far from that tree.
Okay, well, he says, "See, I knew I could do it, Dad." And I'm like, "Okay,
well,
you win.
Some people have that innate ability about them. You know, I mean, I've seen guys with bait casters
do
the same
thing. I think it's more of your attitude. If you go into it scared, you're going to screw it up.
Sure.
You know?
But there's one more bait I always found it was interesting. We used to use it for striped bass quite a bit. And I forget the name of the bait, but it was like a jump bait. It had a torpedo shape, but towards the back it had a little shelf going back towards the tail. And what you did is you worked it on the surface, and then you jerked the line, and it would jump out of the water and drop back in again.
Okay.
Those were great on bass that were schooling, on striped bass that were schooling. Because that's what they were hitting. They were hitting the minnows that were jumping up and out of the water.
Yeah.
So. Right. And you've got some other ones up there like chuggers, you know, just like a popar, rebel popar.
That's right.
But they make the big ones that are just basically...
The chug bugs.
Any of those things where it's a concave face, it's kind of a V-shaped, almost like a laughing face.
Yeah, right. In the freshwater, it'd be like the hula popper.
Yeah, just like a hula popper, exactly.
The spook came out with that one here a few years ago. They've put that little concave...
Yeah.
Popper thing on it.
Yeah.
And it's not like the chug bug where it covers the whole face of it. It's just kind of a cup on the bottom side of the nose of it.
Sabeel has something like that, doesn't he, with a little chugging face on it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but he also has his own company in Alabama.
Alabama, I think.
Band of... Oh, man, I can't remember. He's going to hate me for that because Patrick's a pretty good guy.
Yeah.
But... They, you know, they got a lot of these top water, they call them poppers.
Right.
You know, the face is concave, but they make them from 3 inches all the way up to 12 inches long.
Yeah, I saw one at the tent show that he had there. What a very interesting lure with little ribs on the side.
And yeah. But a lot of companies do make them, you know, obviously Rapala makes them, but Rebel's known for their smaller size, which would be a more appropriate around here, but... A lot of guys in the last couple of years have really gotten excited with the offshore aspect of it for amberjack, cobia. If you travel the world, they use it for some of the different species of tuna and giant trevally. But they're a giant popper, and all you're doing is, once again, you're keeping your rod tip pointed towards the water and just giving it a hard yank. And that concave face makes a big gurgle and a big splash of water that's pushed forward. So it's basically simulating a bait that's being attacked or chased that's running
through the water.
Running like heck to get away from something that wants to eat it. The biggest drawback is with that is still seeing that explosion when that fish comes up and hits is not setting the hook when you see that explosion happen. Not only do you jump and flinch, but you also want to set the hook. And the most difficult thing to get used to is waiting to feel that bit of pressure on the end of your line to signify that that fish has got a hold of it.
Yeah, I think it's common when you see the explosion on the surface is to try to set the hook at that instant. And basically all you're doing is pulling the lure away from the fish. That's
pretty
why
much.
They miss.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, too. I mean, where a lot of people mess up is they're doing that. You got to wait for that hit. But then a lot of them, as soon as that fish hits, they stop. They just freeze.
Yeah. Well, that's instinct. And you tend to freeze.
You
sometimes.
Can't do that. Keep working it. Because I can't tell you how many times I've had snook hit, miss, and just keep coming back. As long as you keep working it,
yeah.
I mean, they'll follow it right to the boat.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely. Now, with the offshore that's going on out there, you know, because we've talked about the amberjack out there, I've been getting a lot of reports on lesser and greater amberjack out there in that 25 to 35 mile mark. What are you hearing about some of the other offshore stuff that's going on?
The thing that
is
kind of surprising
for
me
it.
Is that the grouper have kind of disappeared here recently.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not getting any good reports on grouper. One or two here and there, but nobody that's going out and just absolutely slaying them, bringing in limits and stuff. I mean, now, Jim was in last week. He had a trip. I want to say it was one day last week, and they caught some really nice red grouper.
Right.
I mean, big ones. They didn't limit out, but the ones they caught were barn doors.
Right.
And
true fire trucks in that 30-inch range?
Absolutely. Bigger.
Yeah.
34, 35 inches.
Wow. Now that's a big red grouper.
Yeah. You but they are doing well on is mangs.
Yeah.
They're tearing mangs up out there.
Yeah, for nice a while there was hardly any mangrove snapper around, but now you're getting some better reports. What are you hearing about the mangs? How deep of water and how are they catching them?
Dropping shrimp a lot of times and pinfish if you can get them.
If you can get them.
And that's the issue. I mean, they're not readily available right now for one reason or another.
Now, the shrimp migration is just about done?
Honestly, usually March is like the kind of the peak of it. You know, but this year's been so off, you know.
I was going to say, this year it seemed like it was early.
December and January were absolutely phenomenal. February wasn't too bad, so yes, it very well could likely be over. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the weather's been so unbelievably beautiful, but if we look back at the calendar last year, February was actually pretty darn nice, with only a couple days in the 30s and 40s, and then it warmed right back up into the high 70s to even
like
the mid-80s. Just like it did this year. But last year in March, Mother Nature kicked us again, and we went back into the highs in the mid to upper 70s with a lot of lows in the 40s. So it put us back on track to the normal time of year. So if we get that, that will keep those shrimp around a little bit longer. So they might, you know, we still might have another really good March involved with the shrimp. But
yeah, and I think that's why they're doing so well offshore with shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of shrimp out there, and there's not a lot of finned bait out there.
There is not.
Right. And I think part of that is, I think part of it with the pinfish, because we've had a lot, we haven't been able to get pinfish in the shop for about 3 months, maybe 4 months. There's very few pinfish that I'm hearing about along the intercoastal, definitely almost none up inside the harbor. I think part of it is definitely red tide, I think, put a real big hurting on all the babies, because it's almost always in May and June is when those pinfish will hatch out. And, well, no, that's actually a little earlier. It's usually in March that they start to hatch out. And the flats will be loaded with little baby pinfish in that 2 to 2.5 inch size, basically silver dollar size, in June. And then come August to September, when the redfish start to show up in their schools, is when those pinfish are now 3 to 4 inches, which are just that perfect eating size. this year, I think they really got hammered by the Red Tide, I think, is all part of it.
Yeah, we were looking at a lot of the images that people were posting on Facebook.
Yeah, a lot of dead pinfish.
A lot of dead pinfish in that. So pinfish, grunts. They got hit really, really, really hard, adults and
yeah, everyone gets all sympathetic about a big snook. And yes, it's a drag. You know, big redfish, it's a bummer. You know, any fish that's dying from that red tide is a bummer. But like you said, you see all those pictures. If you actually look at it, you know, it's like
all the smaller bait fish and stuff.
If you're looking at a fountain in the middle of, say, Central Park, and somebody throws a $50 bill in there, you're going to notice that. But you're not going to notice that there's $1,000 in quarters at the bottom of that thing.
Right.
And people forget about that looking at these images of the red tide of all the little tiny bait fish. You know, we've talked about that nobody counts the microscopic babies from the redfish and the snook that died, you know, because you can't see them.
Right, and we'll see that impact a little later on, and probably this time next year we're going to see that impact.
Exactly, but the immediate impact of that is those pinfish is a huge part of it, and that's one of the main food sources that's around here for a lot of our fish. And to see that there's very few
shrimp and pinfish are the main menu, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And if you eliminate either one of them, you're going to eliminate the game fish as well. I mean, if there's nothing for them to come here and eat, they're not coming. You know.
Right. But I mean, I like his observation of it though, because I mean, if people want to look back and they're asking why there's no pinfish around, look back at some of those photographs that you're seeing of the beach. Ignore that one big fish that's the center of the picture and look at the frame around that fish and see the littered little silver dollar size shiny things and realize that those are small bait fish, most of them, and in particular, most of them were pinfish.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's been a big part of some of our issues that we're seeing with the lack of, you know, lack of being able to find them.
And it was ugly outside in the Gulf for a long time after that red tide started.
We had red tide, and then we had that black algae come in, which made the entire water column hypoxic, because the red tide offshore usually doesn't affect the pinfish because the pinfish are a bottom dweller. But when that black tide hit, it went through from the surface all the way to the bottom, sucked all the oxygen out. I mean, it killed the crabs, it killed the shrimp, it killed the fish. You know, that is far worse than the red tide because it just, you can't breathe, you can't live.
Sure.
So everything felt an impact from that. I mean, even we saw that with the stone crabbers this year, where the stone crabbers usually set their stuff out at 5 miles and 7 miles. After 3 weeks or 2 weeks of it soaking, they had no crabs, so they actually had to pull up all their hundreds of traps and move them out 15, 20, 25 miles out just to start finding stone crabs because they had been hit so hard.
Yeah, I saw some underwater photography that a number of divers in the area gathered and disseminated, and it was amazing to see how many dead crabs and dead mantis shrimp and things like that that are normally just not affected by red tide whatsoever.
Yeah, I saw some of that.
Off of Boca Grande, it was littered with dead mantis shrimp.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty wild.
I think it was Chris O'Neill.
Yeah.
Had put a lot of photography and films up on Facebook, and I was watching some of that, and it showed these guys up there off Sarasota and all down through Venice and that, and they're going, and it was just a desert there. There was dead crabs, like you said, mantis shrimp, crustaceans, and they'd swim over to them and touch them with their finger, and they just crumble.
Yeah,
they were dead. You know, I mean, it was pretty sad.
The hopeful side of this is eventually nature fixes itself, and eventually those areas will come back. But it doesn't happen quickly.
Nope.
No,
it doesn't happen quickly.
Well,
if we don't manage those areas properly, it may take a lot of years for it to come back if we don't manage.
Right now, we're being lulled into a false sense of security because for the last several weeks, the red tide report has been that there is no red tide.
And the water is beautiful.
And the water is beautiful. So everybody goes, oh, I heard them saying it last night on CBS News, the locals, oh, the water's beautiful, the red tone, no red tide, blah, blah, blah. So we're going to go back to business as usual. The big hoo-hurrah that was raised over, you know, the blue-green algae, the red tide this past year, it'll subside slowly into the background again, and we'll lose the impetus that we gained for them to be doing something about it in the first place. And
right,
I think
that's right on. That's right on, because that's exactly what's happening. You know, all these people were mobilizing against Red Tide.
Exactly.
And putting pressure on the legislature and everything else. And now that the water's clean and pretty, everybody's quiet again.
It's the attention span of a gnat, basically.
Pretty much.
You know, that's what it boils down to.
And quit insulting the gnats.
Well, that's our news cycle, and it's just what we've kind of been ingrained into us over the time, you know, unfortunately. But enough about the Red Tide. So, you know, we got the mangrove snapper bite offshore.
Yep, and they're great.
You got the AJs have been out there, but we've been hearing good reports of cobia, which are starting to show up out there. Been a couple of oddball permit. You know, been still really hearing good numbers of lane snapper. But the
yellowtail snapper on fire out there right now.
I've
talked to several people that are just going out there and catching stupid amounts of yellowtail snapper. I mean, my neighbor was talking to a friend of his. They'd been out, this was probably about 10 days ago now. They brought in so many yellowtail snapper. There was four of them on a boat. They were limited out. Four of the yellowtail snapper they caught were over 10 pounds.
Right.
And if they had not decided they were eating them and had put them up like they would normally do if they were considering a trophy fish, all four of them probably would have broken the current state record.
Yeah, that's a big yellowtail.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people don't realize that we have so many yellowtail snapper out there.
Right.
But the number one mistake that people make for our yellowtail is they're not fishing for them, because they're fishing for snapper and grouper on the bottom.
Yep.
And these yellowtail here, you've got to essentially chum a lot and use shrimp as one of your best baits, or glass minnows is another really good bait, and free line it out the back of the boat or on a small circle hook jig head. That you can just feed the line out and let it drift out with the current, falling at almost the same natural state as your chum slick. Because those fish are going to come way up in the water column. You know, you can be in 100 feet of water, and they'll come up to within 5 feet of the surface. And that's where you're going to find your yellowtail snapper at, is by chumming real heavy, using lighter leader, lighter rod. You're going to use your snook and redfish tackle, essentially. But you're going to use 15... pound fluorocarbon leader, 5 to 10 feet of it at least, and just free line that bait out the back of the boat and hold on. You know, and it's fun because you're fishing for a big snapper that fights pretty hard. Even if it's a 2 pound yellowtail, that's a pretty good quality yellowtail. But you're fighting him, but then you're also trying to keep it away from
Cuda.
The barracuda and the amberjacks
and
have been out there too, and they enjoy eating them as much or more so than we do. You know, so it can be a fun challenge, but a lot of people don't realize the population of yellowtail we have. So that's something that's always fun. But another yellowtail that people have been getting excited about to bring it from the offshore into the inshore, giant jacks.
Yeah.
You know, Jack Crevel is their real name, but some people call them yellowtail jacks or yellowfin jacks, but true name is Jack Crevel. And there's been 10, 15, and 20-pound jacks in schools throughout the entire harbor.
Yep. Well, and this time of year, going up the river, up the Peace River, there's a favorite spot of mine up there. They get out on this one flat, and I really don't want to say where it's at because I'm sure there'd be 50 boats there in the next couple, 3 days. But they're there every spring. I can pretty much figure the end of February through the first 2 or 3 weeks of March, they're going to be schooled up out on this flat. And I'm talking three-foot, four-foot jacks. I mean, big jacks.
Right. You know, and one of my favorite places of fish is up by your place, up there right there at El Jobin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, those big jacks, I've been hearing reports of them there in the mornings at the bridge, but I've also been hearing some reports up the river a little bit. I don't know if you're seeing it or hearing that up there.
Yeah, I'm hearing up the river, too. I got a number of friends that live further up on the river, you know, maybe up to 2 miles from the bridge, yeah. And they're catching big jacks.
Well, this is the time of year for that. Yeah. And I don't know if the jacks go up the river to spawn or what it is.
I think it's just a natural food source because there's a lot of mullet that congregate in the wintertime up in the Myakka and the Peace River, which that's one thing that the Game and Fish do is they do shut down certain sections for commercial netting of mullet in the harbor, where the upper Myakka River gets shut down for a couple months, the upper Peace River gets shut down for a couple months, but it's not as a whole, but this time of year, those big jacks go up there looking for some of those bigger schools of mullet, and for me, they're at Eljo Bean, and then also just up from Eljo Bean, if I'm fishing from a boat, that first island that's on your left, what's that? That's Gulf Cove. On your left, but there's an island up about, what, half a mile, three quarters of a mile up? That spot right there, there's a couple little oyster patches around there, and sometimes those jacks get stacked around that, and it's just an absolute unbelievably good time.
And catching a 5-pound jack is like catching 20 pounds of anything else.
Oh, yeah. Pound for pound, they give you the best fight of any fish we got out here.
Yeah. That would, Frank would say if jacks could jump, they would be the number one game fish.
They would be. I mean, and, you know, tarpon's my most favorite fish to catch, period.
Yeah.
But if jacks acted half of what a tarpon does for jumping, jacks would definitely be number one on my list. And they're just way underrated. But another cool spot is, even if you can't find them that way, is troll. Just do light trolling, and you can either troll down the river, you know, go from, say, Port O'Call and go up around the Eljo Bean Bridge and just parallel it, and then work your way up the river going down the channel.
75 bridge is good for that,
75
too.
Bridge, but also your Punta Gorda Isle canals and your Port Charlotte canals, same way, just troll a small, like 4-inch hard bait. Like one of my personal favorites for trolling is Rapala X-Rap in a number 10 series, which is about 4.5 inches long. But Bomber is absolutely an amazing one to troll through there because they track right.
Yep.
They're a semi-floating or floating lure, so they're not going to dive real deep. You don't have to let them out a long ways. And in the scheme of things, honestly, they're relatively inexpensive compared to some of your depth-specific lures that are out there. Then you're trying
You can buy a Bomber for $6, you know, $7. And a big one is, what, $9?
For
big Bomber? Not the big depth specific.
Not the depth specific ones,
like
but
the 16s.
Yeah.
And the bigger jacks do a fine job of destroying lures.
Yes, they do.
You know, pretty close to one jack per lure. The other thing about trolling on the Myakka is you got to do it slow.
Well, you have to anyway, because that manatee zone.
Don't be in a hurry to go from one place to the other while you're trolling. You know, I've seen guys do that. Well, they're going to go further up the river, so they throw a couple things out the back, and they head up the river. I mean, there isn't a fish alive that's going to catch up with that bait.
No, that's not speed trolling.
Just putter along, and it's well worth the effort because the jacks are all over the river right now.
Well, and this time of year is, you know, like the guys that launch up at West Spring Lake and that.
Mm-hmm.
I used to launch from there a lot, you know, years back, and I always dragged a lure out of there. And, you know, you're putting along 3 or 4 miles an hour, and I'd throw that X-Rap out there behind me, you know. And I can't tell you how many jacks, snook, you name it. I've caught
juvenile
it all
tarpon.
Coming out of there. Yeah.
You know, the juvenile tarpon have been really good up there on the Myakka, you know, and guys are catching those trolling. A lot of guys are catching those trolling.
I heard they're catching them as far up as Snookhaven.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had one report this week personally from up there around Snookhaven, just before it, really.
Yeah.
But those tarpon will go all the way up to Myakka State Park. You know, if you're looking for them and you want to go on a really beautiful scenic boat ride, you know, that's been pretty impressive up there. And it's that area is way underutilized, I believe, and appreciated, really. You know, it's a little tricky to fish it, but it's pretty amazing. You know, so
I think the Peace River gets more advertisement.
It does
than the Myakka,
and it's larger though.
And it is larger.
Once you get above 41 on the Myakka, it starts to get pretty skinny.
Yeah.
You know, you're almost fishing more or less a creek than you are a river.
That's right, yeah.
You know, versus the Peace River, hey, you don't get into a creek until you get above Arcadia.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you can fish the Peace River all the way to Arcadia. And, I mean, there you got to watch where you're going and what sure. you're doing. You don't want to just go ramming through there like you're out in the middle of the harbor. But you pretty much can go all the way to Arcadia without any issue at all.
Right.
And, like you said, the Myakka, it's tricky once you get above the Hunt Estate. You know, you start having to watch what you're doing there.
Yep.
And the weather's been beautiful, so, I mean, that's been one really great aspect of it, is that we haven't had a lot of strong wind to make for lower tides. They've been a little skinny, don't get me wrong, but they haven't been super skinny because we haven't had those northeasterly winds
right.
that are usually sustained and dump that water out of the harbor big time.
Yeah, it hasn't been roaring down the river all year this year.
Yeah, so getting up there and taking your time, and like you said, trolling along at a very slow speed, 2 to 3 knots, dragging a lure behind you, it's a way to find fish, but it's also a way to really familiarize yourself with the river, whether it's the Myakka River or the Peace River, and just take your time and go along it and enjoy it and check it all out. And don't be afraid to experiment with your soft plastic lures up there if you want to try to fish some of those deeper pockets or just some of the beautiful overhangs or docks, anything you come across mm-hmm. up there, because you never know what you're going to sure. run into on the Peace River this time of year. And let's face it,
could
Mother Nature has made it very warm, so the fish are really, really active up on the Peace River and the Myakka River, for that matter. So play around with it. The only thing I will suggest is if you are taking any kind of bait up there, whether you're fortunate enough to find pinfish or you're taking a shrimp with you, for some reason the bait is not staying alive very well on upper river. Both the Peace River and the Myakka River, I've had. Normally this time of year, you can buy shrimp, hang them in your bucket off your dock up there, yeah. even up as far as right here off of Biscayne, and usually keep your shrimp alive for sometimes a day or two. This year, for some reason, it's just not happening, and I think it's some of these weird rains that have been happening in the middle of the state have maybe been affecting the aquifer or something, where the salinity is yeah. a little too low on both the Peace and the Myakka River.
And maybe the tannins, too. It seems like the river's really dark this year.
Right. So I think and that could be the fresh water flowing through
yeah.
at some point or another, because the river height on the Peace River last week was right at like 3 foot, which
yep.
is about where it should be for this time of year, where it's really not affecting fresh water down below Arcadia. But people are having a very difficult time keeping their bait alive this year for some reason up there. So my suggestion is keep it in a bait bucket with an aerator on it, so that way it's more concentrated and you're going to have a lot less die-off until you're actually ready to use it in those particular spots that you might be looking for. You know, so that's just about the best advice and knowledge that I've gained in this past week, is how the river has been affecting the bait fish itself. Or bait in general, shrimp
right.
and fish. Because a couple guys are finding some white bait out there. You know, they're working for it, but they are finding white bait out there. And some of those guys have been bringing them up into the Myakka and up into the Peace to look for those juvenile tarpon and those bigger jacks with live bait. And
Dying.
I mean, once they make it to El Jobin and just on the other side of El Jobin, it starts dying. And then once they make it up on the Peace River, up just above I-75, it starts dying. So,
down south, they've been getting some bait out along the beaches and stuff.
I've been hearing some down there by Estero Bay.
Yep,
Estero Bay has had some, and then off of
Sanibel,
what's that, Knapp's Point?
Yep,
out there off the beach. Yeah, and the cool part is, even though like we're talking about jumping back out, I'm pulling a Frank and jumping out to a totally different section again, offshore. You know, the guys have been seeing a ton of bait out there. They've been sabiquing up Spanish sardines, scaled sardines, which is our white bait or greenbacks, and thread fins. They're seeing all those out there in different schools of different sizes all over the place out there. And some Spanish mackerel have been mixed in with them. A few bonita have been mixed in with them, you know, with the exception of king mackerel.
Right.
You know, there's been a lot of bait fish being seen from 3 miles out to 35 and 40 miles, but the best concentration of it seems to be in that 45 to 75 feet of water, which is what, 12 miles to 20?
Yeah, 12 miles out to 20.
Roughly?
20, yep, roughly.
Okay. So
there's some hope that some of that bait's going to make its way in.
Yeah, and even if anything, even if it's out there and hatches and gives, you know, makes for small offspring, the juvenile hatch will come into the harbor and hang out throughout the springtime and into the summer, waiting for those rains to start pouring out that basically nutrient-rich water for them to feed on, because all those small bait fish, yep, and even small game fish need that phytoplankton to feed on, and the little zooalgae, all that, or zooplankton, I'm sorry. You know, they need all that to feed on, so they rely on those rivers flowing heavy, so hopefully they'll start to move in a bit closer and we'll actually see some bait fish in and around the harbor in better numbers than what we're seeing right now, which should be pretty awesome.
It should be better, for sure, you know. I mean, it's, again, you know, we have natural predation, and then we have us, you know, and
unnatural predation.
we are our own worst enemy when it comes to so many things in our environment, whether it's on land or in the water, you know. And I mean, bait is way scarcer now than it's been in years.
It's not a renewable resource.
It is not. I mean, it is to a certain extent, but
no, if you leave it alone, if you throw a cast net on it, that's like 400 pelicans at the same time,
exactly,
pouncing on a school of bait fish. I mean, you know, it just, it's not going to last. And these guys are wanting to throw smaller nets.
Yeah. Everybody wants a quarter-inch mesh.
Yeah.
I actually had a guy come in and ask me down in the other store if we made one smaller.
Yeah, an eighth-inch mesh.
I don't know if they make one smaller or not. I said, but we don't sell it.
Yeah, I told a guy one time, because we had a guy last year, same thing. I told him, you just might as well buy a seine net if you're going to go that small. You know, because, you know, if you're throwing that small a bait, you know, number one, you're killing every one of them that you try to put a hook into, and there's no way to cast it. But it's never had a chance to breed yet. That's
right.
Still a
sub-adult
baby.
You're killing next year's bait.
Exactly. You know, and all that in the name of saying that you caught 50 snook that were 10 to 20 inches long.
Yeah,
you
big
know,
deal.
Wow. I'm impressed.
Well, you know, if I get on my soapbox, one of the things that's always annoyed me, you know, back in the days when I was writing for Outdoor Life magazine, I never understood competitive fishing.
Yeah.
It made no sense to me that you would go out, have all this adrenaline, and throw all these fish into the live well, and
I caught more fish than you did.
Yeah, and it just never made sense to me. It didn't seem like this is what fishing is all about. And I think it's time to kind of move back in the direction of fishing is supposed to be fun, it's relaxing. Yes, it can be exhilarating when you get some big fish wacky on the top, all of that. But it's not about how many you caught.
No.
No, it's about the quality of the day that you had while you were out there and that you brought something back to feed the family. You know?
Well, and I'm at the point in my life with fishing, and have been for quite a while, where being on the water is enough for me. Catching fish is a bonus.
That's right. And that's how you should look at it, too.
And, yeah, and I mean, anybody that looks at it differently, I probably don't want to talk to them.
Well, they're missing something. There's a whole piece of the experience, and it's a major piece of the experience that you're missing if you're going out there for numbers.
Yep.
And if you're going out there to compete because you want to win some prize, you know, like the redfish tournaments and things like that, they just don't make sense to me, and that's not the purpose of fishing. But that attitude is, we go back to getting the smaller nets, that attitude where you're going to grab tons of stuff.
Sure.
And you probably don't need to. You know, what are you going to do with all those fish? They're going to die on you anyway. You can throw them over the side, you know, and the crabs are going
to
eat them.
When I first came to this coast from the other coast back in 1998, you could drive over the 41 bridge going over Charlotte Harbor and look down the harbor, and you would see schools of bait just as far as you could see from one side to the other and on down. Nowadays, you drive over the bridge, if you see a small pod of bait anywhere out there, it's kind of amazing because we've killed it all.
I remember for years my daughter and I did the Freedom Swim every 4th of July, swim across the Peace River, you end up at Fisherman's Village.
Yep.
And in the early years of doing that, you sometimes were surrounded by bait fish.
Sure.
Put your hand in the water to stroke, and you get this boil of fish around you.
Yeah.
And in the last several years, I haven't seen any at all.
That's because it's not there anymore.
Yeah, right. Not there anymore.
You know, and the funny part is, when I was a kid, I'd hear people tell these stories.
Yeah.
About back then, it was like this. And I'd chuckle. But now I'm sitting here hearing you talking about, you know, just in the last basically a century.
20 years.
Even yeah. going back only
years.
Like, say, 15.
Yeah.
Was a huge turnaround point with the bait fish.
Sure.
And I've seen it, you know. I mean, yes, I'm getting old, obviously. You know, that's normal. But it is surprising with the lack of those bait fish, you know. And it's like, you know, Frank goes on his soapbox about the Save This or this conservation group or that conservation, you know, and they want to put 10,000 redfish into the harbor and release these. And, oh my gosh, he did a great thing for the west coast of Florida by releasing all of these fish. Well, none of that means anything if you don't have food for them. And you're talking, and this is going to be a real bad stretch, but you've got commercial fishing of mullet, you've got year-round, you've got a year-round commercial fishing of blue crabs, and then you've got the white bait, which is seasonal. You know, these are all major food sources for every one of our game fish that we have in our area, and yet they won't do anything to protect those. You know, we're allowed to go
You're
out
forgetting
and
take one of them, shrimp.
On shrimp too.
They take that year round, and
it's you go up on the Peace River or the Myakka River, and there's hundreds and hundreds of blue crab traps.
Yep.
To the point where it looks like a minefield from World War II.
Right.
You know, and it's amazing that a single blue crab even gets to make it to adulthood anymore. You know, if we were to reduce some of that fishing, you know, and I'm not saying stop these guys from doing it, because doing that kills me too, because I rely on commercial fishing as a bait shop. We buy mullet, we buy shrimp, we buy crabs, we buy all this stuff too, so I'm part of the problem too. But I realize that there's got to be a certain point of, you know, there should be no fishing for roe mullet for several months. You know, they can have the beginning of the season, say in November, but December, January and February, when that's their prime months, they shouldn't be allowed to take those pregnant mullet, let them reproduce. Blue crabs should be cut down for, you know, it's every other year they have to pull their traps for 2 weeks while they do a cleanup. But other than that, blue crabs are open year round. There should be a closed season for that too. You know, and, you know, to allow them to replenish themselves, to replenish all the other foods, you know, all the other game fish and all the other fish, period, that would be a huge, huge increase. So letting all the redfish and snook go you want doesn't mean anything unless they have something
to eat
and survive on. And
and that's like this redfish snook closure that they came up with over the red tide. I mean, yeah, okay, maybe it needed to be done, maybe it didn't. I don't think it really mattered much, because it hasn't taken the pressure off of them. Because
no.
We still have everybody out there fishing for them, and they kill more fish releasing them than the ones they're taking.
Right. Well, and they're still going to fish for them, but there's a lot of people that won't fish for them because they aren't allowed to keep them, so therefore it becomes incidental bycatch. So I get the closing part of it for that aspect of
right.
it. I don't agree with their reasoning for closing it.
I
think, like Frank said, was political. I'll agree with him on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was more about saving face, because there were so many people crying about the dead fish on the harbor in the past, you know, that there's
Even
some
though,
legitimacy
like
to that.
RJ pointed out, most of the fish that they were seeing were dead were not redfish and snook. They were any of the bigger fish. It was mostly the smaller bait fish, the stuff that we do need to protect.
Those are the things that we need to work on. You know, it's like you said, it's out of sight, out of mind right now with
sure.
the red tide and the blue-green algae. You know, nobody has ever stopped to think about the food source for all of these great things that keep our harbor healthy. You know, they need to start taking note of that and really paying attention to it, because we all want to have our children, grandchildren, to have the same memories that we've been sitting here contemplating and whining about. We want them to all have a good thing. So, you know, But, you know, off with that, you know, winding down. Weather's beautiful for the next several days. Offshore fishing's great. There's some juvenile tarpon around. A lot of snook and redfish with small sizes.
Yep.
Offshore fishing's been amazing. Take advantage of the beautiful weather and go out and go fishing and enjoy some quality time. Even if you don't catch any fish, enjoy some very good quality time with your friends and family. And hopefully we did a pretty good job. I know Frank's better at this than I am. But
I don't know if we need Frank anymore.
Nah, we do.
I'm not coming up here every week.
But I appreciate you listening, and thank you, folks.
I'm going fishing, hook, sinker, and line. I said fish.